Good evening, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's lecture on behalf of the LSE Environmental Initiatives Network. I'm particularly pleased to be welcoming Ricky Burdett as our speaker tonight, who will be speaking about London as a sustainable urban forum. Before I introduce Ricky, let me say a few words about the Environmental Initiatives Network and the London Activities Committee. EIN brings together people from across the school community, students, staff, governors, and others with an interest in sustainability and in environmental initiatives. It supports a number of separate initiatives, ranging from volunteering to conferences, events, and also a careers fair for students interested in careers and environmental careers. It's been in existence since 1995, I believe, and since then has grown rapidly. And we're very pleased to have such a range of different people, alumni, students, and others, participating in our events, but also in suggesting all kinds of interesting projects to take forward. If you're interested in joining, you will have a chance to do so after the lecture. I believe there will be a table outside where you can leave your contact details, both if you wish to be informed of future events and if you want to join the network itself. And there are certain membership privileges, like receiving the directory of members as well as some invitations regularly to all events. Moving along to our speaker tonight, Ricky Burdett is a distinguished architectural critic, a commentator, and plays quite an important role in the development and evolution of urban policy in London. He has previously been an advisor to the BBC, to the Heritage Lottery Fund. He continues to be an advisor to the Greater London Authority and to the Mayor's Office on architectural, urban, and environmental questions. More importantly, since 1996, Ricky has been the director of the Cities Program here at the LSE, which aims to bring together architectural urban thinking with social science analysis and research to contribute to a more holistic and comprehensive view of the city as a major nexus of development. The LSE Cities Program has been very successful. It now has been offering a master's degree in city design for the last 6 or 7 years. It features a design studio in which students explore how design challenges, urban planning challenges in London can be addressed from a holistic perspective. It also brings together and facilitates interdisciplinary research on urbanism at the LSE. And lastly, also provides consultancy for London companies active in the urban development space. In the lecture tonight, Ricky will explore what I think can only be called the monumental challenge of bringing London into a more sustainable urban form. And I'm intrigued to hear how Ricky proposes that we address this challenge. So without any further delay, please welcome Ricky Burdett for his lecture.
Thank you, Florian, and thank you to the environmental group for inviting me to give this talk. Can you hear me?
No?
Okay. This may be because this is off. Let's see. Hello, hello? Is that any better? Yeah? Can you hear me? No? Can someone do something about it? I mean, apart from my shouting, otherwise, is there a handheld mic? Hello, can you hear me? Right. Thank you very much. As I say, I'm going to, in a way, try and do the impossible, which talk about a subject which is based on a word which I don't understand, which is sustainability. Probably everyone in the room here is an expert from their own perspective. And also talk about a city which I love and have grown to begin to understand, but don't claim in any way to have a solution, as Florian was suggesting. But what I do want to do, and in a way it's an interesting challenge for anyone involved, in linking policy and research to the issue of understanding urban culture and urban form. What I do want to do is try to talk about the concept of sustainability at least in three different ways. And that's really all I'm going to try and do in this talk. Even though I'm an architect by training and have been at the LSE now, as Florian has mentioned, for nearly 7-8 years, I resist the temptation to use graphs and bullet points. But I think there are three slides with some of those. Most of it is, to a degree, an anecdotal account of what I perceive as being the big issues in London today, and very much an attempt to link and to share with you the relationship between this extraordinary mass that you see here, to try and understand it, which is London seen from a satellite, and the issues which are affecting everyone, not only in this room, but everyone on the ground, living, working, and visiting London. Bruno is very kindly, who works with me at the Cities Programme, doing the horrible task of pressing the button when I say next, because there isn't a link between there and me. So next, please. So this is bullet point number one. And I think the key issue I just want to raise here is that in this brief talk on the issue of sustainability in London, and raising the question about whether London can actually be a sustainable urban model — it's not a statement, I don't think it is, but I think it's an interesting issue to address — it is absolutely critical, I think, to talk about sustainability and to address the issue at these three different levels: at the spatial, at the social, and at the environmental. And at the spatial, I think the argument I want to put forward is an extremely simple one, but perhaps one which eschews many of the policymakers, many of whom I, with others, advise, which is that London is very, very special. In many ways, it's a mess as an urban form, and we'll look into that. And that it actually has certain characteristics of spatial sustainability, not by design, not by planning, not by policy, but by default. And I think that is actually quite an interesting mechanism to compare the city with others. At a social level, I think the issue of sustainability is absolutely clarified by the fact that as London faces enormous growth and change over the next 15 odd years, there's an increase in risk of further ghettoization, of further exacerbating the division between the rich and poor in London. And that is an intrinsically spatial issue, not just a social issue. Clearly an economic one, but that is well beyond my area of expertise. And I do want to talk about the key issue of affordable housing in London, as a model, as a potential model of actually creating mixed communities as opposed to dormitory towns, let's call it that. And the way to achieve that, I think, in linking the social to the spatial, is by increasing permeability, by having access between one area and another, by linking together and weaving together the public spaces of the different pieces of city which are about to grow and develop, and particularly in the Thames Gateway, which is going to be part of the focus of this talk. And lastly, and I think absolutely critically, and it clearly cuts across the other two big agendas, is the environmental or the ecological or the environmental one, the term by which obviously sustainability tends to be talked about far more regularly in the academic debate and in policy terms. And the simple issue here, I think, in terms of the sustainability of London, which is central to this issue of affordable housing and central to the issue of ghettoization, is the fact that without linking public transport development in London to the type of housing development that is proposed over the next 15 years, we really will reverse a model of sustainability, which I think is possible. And the notion of actually reusing land, brownfield land, available land, of which there is much in London, as we will see, and as you know, and reusing buildings in an intelligent way, I think is critical to this equation of creating a potentially sustainable model in London. Next, please. Now, I think one needs to stand back and start back from this image that many of you will know of Europe at night, just to remind ourselves that London cannot be talked about possibly even in the same ways of Paris or Madrid or Rome, more likely to be talked about in similar terms as the geographic area in northeast of Italy from Milan through to Venice, and certainly more comparable to the Randstad in Holland, where the three great cities of Rotterdam, The Hague, and Amsterdam actually create one of the megalopolises, one of the major metropolitan areas of Europe. But it is interesting to see what the sort of geographic condition that London and the southeast and England as a whole actually relate to when you consider if this is a statement of literally where the lights are on, where the lights are out. You know, no one's in Ireland and hardly anyone in Wales and very few up in Scotland. And it also points to an issue of how does actually one work with the grain and range of development and intensity of development which exists there. Because if we begin to look into that next, we will see that there are several levels at which the whole of London and its hinterland need to be understood. Let's just remind ourselves in any discussion about a city like London that we're effectively talking about a nation state in many ways in terms of literally the scale of numbers of people and the scale of the economic pulling power that it has. The whole of the southeast is roughly 50 million and growing. London is very similar to New York. At the moment, it's just over 7 million. It's in fact 7.3 million, and we'll see later that it's projected to grow to over 8.3 million. Its GDP is the equivalent to Saudi Arabia, just to put things into perspective. And it's considered officially by the government, not just by we Londoners, as a key driver of the UK economy, contributing to the exchequer anything between 7.5 and 15 billion pounds a year. So we're talking about a regional economy which is actually contributing money to outside. And as we know, much of that money doesn't come back in terms of investment and investment in those two key issues which I've already mentioned, public transport and housing. Next, please. And it's also a political squabbling ground. You will recognize the happy young man here on the left with Richard Rogers smiling 1995. Less easy to see here, but that's Ken Livingstone with Richard Rogers, also looking exactly the same after 9 years, quite amazing. The two politicians have aged somewhat. Both, really, the two politicians talking and squabbling and having a debate about what London is about in terms of the UK economy, but most importantly, how it should be governed. Because let us remember that even though here I am talking as an advisor to the Mayor of London, many other people, 600-700 people employed by the GLA, London is still governed by 33 boroughs. Effectively, all the key decisions which affect sustainability at one level or another, key planning decisions, let's call it that, are still the remit today of the 33 London boroughs. And if you just compare back to the New York model that I showed before, remember we're talking about a city with roughly the same number of people. London occupies twice the footprint as New York, but it's actually governed by only five boroughs. And the mayor has a very strong executive hand, which is sometimes used and often abused. But nonetheless, this is an important sort of political factor in the background to actually the key decisions which are made about London. The bizarre thing is that, you know, we wouldn't be here talking about this world city. We wouldn't be talking about the fact that it's experiencing a period of exponential growth, that it's still a visitor attraction to more than 24 million people a year and growing, that major banks and corporations are coming here. All this happened, and this is the bizarre thing that one needs to share and understand. I have no precise model to explain it at all. Has happened over the period that London has been the most politically fragmented ever since the demise of the GLC to the year 2000. So I think the issue for any of us talking about sort of sustainable growth and sustainable political management is to address that issue. Next, please. So, as I mentioned before, if you look inside that satellite view of London or of the southeast of England and you begin to focus in, this is what you see. And it's incredibly difficult for anyone, even if this picture is slightly out of focus, to be fair, it's incredibly difficult to begin to understand what the DNA of London is. What is its sort of fine structure between the public spaces, the streets, and the houses which define the streets, and the parks, and the river? Probably the only thing which jumps out at you, even in this rather bad slide, is the fact that the river is incredibly dominant. And that the parks are very, very significant in terms of marking the quality and the physiognomy of this city. You also see emerging all along the Thames, for reasons that we know well, which is the deindustrialization from the 70s on, large areas of undeveloped land, otherwise known as brownfield land. And I'll be returning to that in terms of the potential of that area, which is, of course, the key policy of redevelopment and accommodating growth and housing in the Thames Gateway. But I just want to, before we move on to that issue later in the talk, focus on this issue of the morphology and its organic quality. Next, please.
Because if one does a little analysis, and this is a very architectural game, and many of you who are designers in the room recognize it, no doubt. If you take what is known as a pretentiously in our trade, the figure ground of a city, and you just draw all the buildings in black and all the avenues and streets in white, and you do this to four cities, you get a very clear picture. You will recognize, no doubt, that that is Manhattan, part of downtown. This is the great Barcelona grid by Cerdà from the late 19th century. This is unmistakably Haussmann's Paris. And this mess here on the left is London. But it's London. We can recognize it. There's something about the relationship between the streets, the crescents, and the public spaces and their continuity, which has a quality which needs to be understood. And if one of the key arguments I want to make about sustainability in spatial terms, one of the key arguments I want to put forward, is that without really working with this grain, without continuing in a way something that London has been able to accumulate over a period of 2,000 years, we will be in a situation of actually creating different Londons over time with different spatial qualities which don't relate to its enduring, other word for sustainable, urban quality. Next, please. Because there, again, is the statement that I've made, the very simple one, that Barcelona, Paris, and London, seen from the air, this has a recognizable physiognomy. We all know where we are in that city. Paris, similarly. London, it's not really clear. So what is it about its structure? Next. Well, London is made up, first of all, of many parts, but each have their own sort of identity and, I think, contribute to this notion of sustainable neighborhoods or urban villages. A lot of London is that. That really could be anywhere. As it happens, it's part of Stoke Newington. London is also partly that, which is private real estate developers from the 18th century onwards making investments, going bankrupt, remaking money, the buildings changing over time, now prove to be what I would call the most enduring, sustainable type of development you can have. If this is actually responded to changes in demographic and economic growth over the last 200 years. If a building which is 7 stories or 6 stories high can work for a family with upstairs and downstairs and servants, but also for hippies in the 60s and lawyers today, then you actually have an enduring building type. And I think that must be part of the project that we set ourselves. The role of public space, the role of parks, I think, in London is absolutely instrumental in terms of understanding how it works. And this picture up on the right, of course, is just as characteristics of the bits of London which are often unloved, but are clearly identified with most of the people's lives who actually live. This is a view of an area near the 813 in East London, with new development looming up behind the sort of little cottages, cottages from the early part of the 20th century. Next, please. This is London. This is a London we know, some people love and want to keep. Next. Ian Sinclair waxes lyrical, as many of you will have read his novels, talks about the A13 as a semi-celestial highway, lovely corridor of light that feeds the imagination. So how does one go forward next and begin to plan the future of London and try to keep all these characteristics? That, I think, is, I guess, the challenge for any urban scholar, but also any urban policymaker, which is, of course, the theme of the moment. Now, there's another level that I think, and this reflects very much the attitudes and the thinking of the LSE Cities program. There's one other level, several other levels, at which one has to understand the DNA of a city. And this is one of them. This is this extraordinary diagram, which I have to say I would stare at for hours. I'm sorry about that. Which just shows the transport accessibility in London. And what it shows in dark purple are the areas which, in terms of public transport, so buses and tube and trams, are easily accessible to other parts, and in dark blue, the ones which are least accessible. And you get a picture which is actually quite clear about central areas being well connected. You begin to see bits such as that. You wonder, well, what is that over there? Why is that connected? Why is that over there? And that's Croydon with its good train connections. That is the emerging Stratford. But another thing which is very clear is that while parts of West London, and we'll return to this with some of the research we've been doing in a very graphic way, parts of West London, relatively speaking, are well connected. There's more yellow and red, more of the hotter colors. A lot of the East Thames corridor, the Thames Gateway, which is always recognizable from, obviously, here, the Isle of Dogs, that way, is cold and blue and poorly served by public transport. Therein lies, I think, one of the problematics to understand the potential and the opportunities of London. If you want to do development there, in short, and you don't put transport, you have a serious problem. Next. Another level you can understand, and I'm not going to try and explain it, but I think it's important, is the work of many of the urban analysts. This happens to be Bill Hillier and the Space Syntax Group at the Bartlett School of Architecture, in understanding how behind sort of the lack of sort of orderly geometry, there is a structure to London which is recognizable. And there is the River Thames in that sort of dark space. And just by analyzing London as a pattern and nothing else, a pattern of connections of streets, which are all these little lines, and analyzing it in computer in terms of accessibility, you get two streets which come out in red, which is the most accessible of all. And one is Oxford Street and the other one is Edgware Road. So there's something about the way London has grown over time which recognizes patterns of global connection and integration. And in blue here, just like with the transport models, you see the quieter, less connected areas, which are clearly sort of the housing neighborhoods and sort of quieter parts of the residential London, both in the city center but on the edges. Next. And then I think there's a critical other diagram which relates very much to the interests of all of you in this room and the London School of Economics more specifically, which is a map of the deprivation of London. Because even though this city is one of the greatest achievers in terms of world economy, we've talked about the statistics a bit before, even though it has some of the richest housing prices and office spaces per square meter than anywhere in the world except for Tokyo at the moment, as far as I know, in darker colors here you see the areas of utmost deprivation. Hackney, I heard the other day at a talk, at a debate there, has all its boroughs in the top 10% of the most deprived boroughs in the United Kingdom, in England, and you can see the nature of the problem, and I think also the nature of the opportunity here, because as you move east again, there is the Thames Gateway starting with the Isle of Dogs, there's this vast area of deindustrialized land, high unemployment, which is clearly demonstrating the levels of deprivation, which is a mixer of unemployment levels, single-person families, low education, high death rate, and other factors. So by taking these three, and if you just flick through backwards and then forwards again, these three issues of transport next, spatial structure, and let's call it, for lack of a better term, socio-economic structure, I think you begin to set up a grid of understanding what the sustainable potential for London might be next. At the center of all of these diagrams, we keep on seeing this winding thing, this extraordinary river, which is the River Thames. And it is curious, if you think of it, unless you happen to be lucky enough in this room to be living close to the river or in a high rise, the river which passes through London is not something which is immediately apparent to us in our everyday experience, unlike the Seine in Paris or the Tiber in Rome or the Hudson in New York. It's sort of hidden, partly because of the morphology of the city itself tends not to relate to the river's edge. And here, I think, again lies a great opportunity in terms of what should happen to this area over the next 10, 15 years, to resist the temptation to lump high blobs of expensive real estate in such a way that they hog the river's edge and turn their back to the surrounding city. But there's a raison d'etre why this has happened, and I think it's quite interesting just to look at a sequence, next please, of how London grew to understand where we are and how it might actually develop from here on. Because if this is a view of London roughly at the time of the ancient Romans, Londinium 2,000 years ago, there is the city, the city walls, the area obviously now included in the Corporation of London, with London Bridge as the first crossing down towards Dover, and the major routes up north and then west to Oxford and other sort of cities, you see that London grew sporadically. Next, roughly in the Middle Ages, it grows a little bit with no other crossing of the river, and you begin to see little villages, little hamlets appearing. Later, as we move towards the 17th century next, the city expands with a second river crossing at Westminster, so you have a split between the center of money and the center of governance, with clearly this part here, the River Thames, with the open sea to the far east on the right-hand side, becoming the center of the maritime trade. But again, keep an eye on the little spots, the little villages outlying in the city. Remember that London, after Roman times, of course, didn't have a wall. It was the island itself, which actually protected the country from potential invasion. So from the 17th, we move over to the 18th, next. And again, the city grows in the sort of slight mushroom-like fashion, but slightly contained. 19th century, next. We have the big explosion with the Industrial Revolution, the big parks and the estates, which we'll look at in a moment. And then, roughly by the beginning of the 20th century, with the arrival of the London Underground Tube, the great explosion in population reaching its peak in the 1920s and 30s of 8.9 million, you get bang, next. The city explodes. It's a city which is nearly uncontrollable. But interesting, you see these big holes, which are very much still there today. Look at that extraordinary line, which is the Lee Valley, which is so recognizable as a sort of score or cut through the city. There's Hyde Park and other sort of open spaces. Next. So behind all that, if you just flick through, Bruno, the sequence very quickly, behind all that, all the little dots that we've seen get absorbed and go forward again and remain as part of the DNA of London's city structure. Next, please. And these are the urban villages. You can call them either hamlets, they're either Greenwich or Chiswick or other parts that London that one knows near in Brent or in North London or in East London. And it's exactly that sort of infrastructure of urban development as a node which is close to a major route of public transport in those days, of course, by road and then over time by rail, which I think needs to be understood and needs to be built upon in creating a sustainable model for London. Next. Because Londoners have always hated plans. I'm not a Londoner, I'm not English. I don't know how many of you in the room are. But there's a sort of wonderful irreverent feeling towards actually being told what to do. Very healthy, I'm sure. You didn't have the Sun King telling you, let's put some axes across. When Christopher Wren tried a few days after the Great Fire of 1666, it was torn up and they rebuilt the city exactly as it was. The only plan, if you can call it that, which I think it is, and I think it's a very significant one in terms of the issues at stake today, is the great Patrick Abercrombie London plan of 43-44, in which the simple suggestion of creating a green belt and major routes out to new towns actually saved London from becoming the sprawling suburban-like city that many of us feel are profoundly unsustainable, many of which clearly we have witnessed over time in the United States. Next, please. And if we now move very fast forward from the plans of the 1940s to a document that you, or a diagram that you may recognize on the right, which is from the Urban Task Force, I think this is the simple connection I want to make. This diagram here, which shows in darker blue what a desirable model of sustainable development is about, with darker blue being poles or areas of greater density, lighter blue less density, being very much arranged in a very geometric, very diagrammatic way here on the right-hand side around public transport routes. You could apply this model, if you half close your eyes, and think of London in this way. That's exactly how I think it works. And I think that's something very precious and important to try and work with as long as the investment is made and as long as the progressive ghettoization, which we've seen along the River Thames, is actually restricted. Next, please. I want to turn briefly, before I move to the Thames Gateway, to one or two small case studies, which I think try and make this bigger point I'm making about London's organic quality and its potential to accommodate change in ways that other cities, I think, might not be able to, and therefore I find interesting, by looking at the Tate and what's happening in the City of London. And I want to look at the Tate Modern for a very simple reason, that if you take the map of deprivation, which I showed you before in other colors, and basically the lighter color is the richer areas and the darker colors are the poorer and more deprived areas, the area which is very light over there is the City of London. And the area which is one of the darkest colors there is the London Borough of Southwark. And the point at which they come together, cheek by jowl, rich and poor, money and unemployed, people in suits, people without suits, is exactly at this point here where the Tate Modern, the Bankside power station, in the mid-90s, epitomized the level of sort of depression facing what happened on the other side of the river. And many of you will know, you will have witnessed that interesting development over time, a building which opened to great acclaim in the year 2000, next please, which turned from a power station into what we know now. It was projected it would attract 2 million people. It's attracted 5 million people in its first 2 years. It's dropped now to 3.5, nearly 4 million on a regular basis. Now, what is interesting to me is that there was a furious debate. Some of you will remember it on looking at the room. Some of you were part of that debate. That the rich north, the city, completely objected to the idea of having a bridge linking those people with us. And the language of the actually planning committees was nearly of that sort, you will remember. Of course, there's a very, very different attitude now if you see the people actually walking through here and who is actually sponsoring the events, who is dining, and who is enjoying the facilities there. Much more importantly, next please, is the effect not just of the transfer of a building rather than getting rid of it, actually turning that into that, turning a turbine hall with turbines and machines into a great public space. Not only is that a significant way of valuing buildings, but this has become one of London's public living rooms, as I'm sure all of you know, and as most visitors to the city now know. Because next, you've seen that, no doubt, people meet, lie on the ground, sit in this place, which would have otherwise been demolished. You meet at 5 o'clock in the turbine hall at the Tate, in an area that only 4 or 5 years ago was really not used, not approached. So the benefits next to this area, not just one of establishing a relationship between two sides, both visual and physical, with the bridge, but also actually contributing enormously to the economy in the area, with all the risks that we know, before you challenge me on this, of gentrification and ghettoization. My argument is a simple one, that London has always worked with these forces of change, driven by private enterprise or private entities such as the Tate Modern and its trustees. The challenge for the public authorities is how do you manage that change to ensure that you don't create these pockets of mutual social exclusion. Next, because this is the scene of the opening day of the bridge, eventually when it stopped swinging, and I think every weekend something like 20,000 to 30,000 people use this as a promenade. Now, my simple argument here, going back to my original statement about the spatial aspects of this multi-centered organic city, is that probably, this might be an exaggeration, but I think it's worth speculating on, probably a city like London, because of its structure, can adapt to this level of change more easily than other more formal geometric cities that one knows of. Next. The other example I wanted to cite very quickly is how an area devastated by bombing, Paternoster Square, in the Second World War, was too quickly, and this is an issue for us today, redeveloped by Lord Helford as the Paternoster Square development. Only 30 years after it was built, it was demolished. Next. And now we have this. Now, I'm not going to comment on architectural style because I don't, that's not really the issue in terms of discussion or mature discussion about cities generally. But what is interesting is that this area, this tight plot right in the heart of the fabric of the city, has been able to change. And probably, there's no doubt, in terms of its urban experience and continuity, an improvement in terms of connecting areas that were otherwise completely disaggregated. Next, please. And the argument clearly applies not just in terms of what happens on a horizontal level, in terms of the developments we've seen, but also in terms of the vertical discussion about tall buildings. Renzo Piano's skyscraper is going to be positioned right above London Bridge City. In an area that probably can take it, if one argues it in terms of simply grounds of capacity, creating a cluster of taller buildings in this area. And again, next, if one looks at this view of what London will be like only 3 years from now, with the Heron Tower, this building, of course, is already built, and 3 or 4 more being built down there, you could take a visual, purely visual argument of saying that in those areas which are well served by public transport, a degree of clustering of towers makes a lot of sense and actually probably improves the visual quality of the skyline rather than these single teeth sort of sticking out rather sadly in the middle of nowhere. But that's a highly visual and rather contentious argument, I know. But it builds on this notion that London is made of different centers with different qualities, which requires a different form of intervention and policy constraint. Next. So let's move now to the realm of what is being discussed out there. What is being proposed by the civic authorities. And this rather lurid diagram, which is in the London plan, is the only drawing, interestingly, the only drawing in the whole of that 500-page document, which gives a sort of two-dimensional, but sort of planar interpretation of how London should grow. And in a moment, I'll try to talk about the issues that Florian touched upon about population growth and sort of the economic challenge and housing challenge for London, and particularly in this area of the Thames Gateway. And what you see here are two or three very simple things. One is the notion that London remains within its boundary, that growth is to happen along these two big corridors of the Thames Gateway and up towards Stansted, that the Greenbelt is preserved as much as possible, and there are areas of growth which are sort of the, in some cases, the red dots, the stars in purple, which are opportunity areas, not just in the Thames Gateway, but within the existing fabric where there is enough capacity, enough space to actually intervene. Next, please. These are the statistics. I think this is the one graph I promised you, which shows that London, which reached a negative peak in the 1980s, having dropped from 8.9 million to 6.4 million, started growing rather dramatically, exactly in the period that I was describing before, which coincided in a way with the demise of the GLC. No doubt more for global reasons and economic issues of deregulation in the city than many others. And roughly we're here now, and it's set to grow by another 600,000, 700,000, or even 800,000 people over the next 15 years, the next 12 years, in fact. Now, just to put that in your mind, that number of people, 600,000, 700,000, 800,000, is the city of Frankfurt or the city of Sheffield, dumped on London as it is today. I mean, that's the scale of new inhabitants who are actually going to move into the city. Next, please. Behind this is also a series of important facts, which I won't go into in detail now, but Tony Travers, our colleague here at the London School of Economics, talks with great significance about the fact that this growth in population that we just saw a moment ago is actually conceals a very problematic issue in terms of creating a sustainable city, which is that, roughly speaking, every year 70,000 people actually move in, 110,000 people move in from abroad into London, but 80,000 normal Londoners move out to other parts of the UK, and these tend to be people with young children seeking the suburbs or seeking the villages with better schools because they can't afford to live here. Now, that trend needs to be reversed, not just in terms of total numbers, but in terms of the type of people who are actually living here. These are bracing statistics, 500% increase in house prices, and that 500,000 people in overcrowded households in London today, at the heart of this debate about a divided London. Next, please. The growth in jobs, the growth, nearly 600,000 new jobs, many of them linked to the city, the growth in number of houses to support the 800,000 people is an important issue which fuels the debate about sustainability. But it's also important to understand that the demographic nature of the incoming inhabitants of London are very different to, in fact, the people in this room here. Most of them are in their late 20s and early 30s. Most of them will only live in London for a short period of time and go and have children elsewhere. The population of London is actually dropping rather dramatically, and there's a divide again between the younger people and the older people living at home. It also represents the typical shift. In the UK, we have the highest divorce rate than anywhere else in Europe, of double units for divorced families to share over weekends, etc. So what is behind this is not just the standard type of family unit who requires the standard type of housing unit. Next, please. Where do you put all this? That's the debate which affects the core of this discussion. Next. Well, the mayor took a decision for all of us in the year 2000, and I've already addressed this, that basically all growth remains within the boundaries of London as we know it. That London, the greater London area shown obviously there with the green belt. And therefore the focus becomes, that's a view of London's River Thames way out east as you go towards Barking and Raynham. How do you use some of that available brownfield land that you can see in the picture there on the right? Next, please. And if you look at what is actually happening out there, and again, I'm keeping away from the issue of style. I only want to focus on one key issue for our discussion on sustainability, which is density. What is actually happening out there is that most of the development being built in the Thames Gateway and elsewhere is of this nature. It's a single unit or a detached unit, or some of them two or three close together, surrounded by large areas of tarmac and very disaggregated urban form. If you were to build the need for the roughly 400,000 units, now it doesn't matter whether it's 300,000 or 500,000, at those sorts of densities, at those sorts of design types, you would need 20 times the area of Hyde Park to accommodate it. So the issue about design, the issue about density, is not just a question of style or image. It's a question of whether we can return to maybe these models of urban form which have been, as I've stressed before, I think genuinely sustainable over time, to respond to the needs of the economic and population growth which I referred to before. Next, please. But there's a problem, because the debate about higher densities is terribly connected with a visceral problem about higher density being equated with high rise. High density equals high rise, and still in most people's minds, even in the current debate in policy making areas. And there is, in the worlds of the Town and County Planning Association and many other very important institutions, a sense that actually higher density comes with all the problems associated with over congestion, ill health of the 19th century city. Now, how do we overcome those issues next? Well, by research. And some of the work we've been doing here at the LSE Cities Program and is being discussed at a seminar here later next month, together with many other academics in the field and policymakers, is trying to get to the roots of what is it about these numbers and the discussions about density which makes places work and not work. Most building in the UK over the last 20 years has been built, built in the UK, has been built at a density of 25 dwellings per hectare. That's a number which means nothing to anyone in the room. This, which is an area of Stoke Newington that we saw before, is 80 dwellings per hectare. This horrible area no one likes is this massive number of 280 dwellings per hectare. The planning regulations which the John Prescott is been pushing strongly and have been more or less adopted by Ken Livingstone, is to aim for a minimum of 50 dwellings per hectare. So it's quite interesting how far the debate has to go to try and return to something which actually works extremely well with the grain of London as we know it. Next. These are not scary parts of the city. Next. And a lot has to do in the debate about density with issues of design, because you can take 70 or 80 units and either put them as a tower block or cut them up as a salami and turn them into streets or make courtyards with a rather nice civic or collective garden in the middle. And they all have the same numeric density, but the difference in quality, the difference in terms of permeability, continuity, and relationship to the overall urban form is absolutely central to the debate about creating a sustainable London. Next. So we're faced with a multi-dense city. This aerial map, this map of London shows the areas which are denser and darker colors. And in this project that we are about to sort of publish in, as I say, a month or so, we looked at many areas, but I just want to show one part of this research, which I think is quite interesting in revealing some of the core issues in terms of the relationship between development form and transport. Next, please. First of all, it's worth noting that the density areas are higher, of course, near the center, but there are lots of areas and more outlying areas in what one refers to as outer London, which are relatively dense. They're parts of East London, certainly areas in West London, Hammersmith, areas in Croydon, parts of Brent, which are actually as dense as the average of inner London. Next. And that applies also to population density. Next. What is interesting is residential occupancy, in other words, units with more housing are all out on the fringes of the city, with more people living in flats, obviously, in the central part. Next. We've seen the map of deprivation focusing on the right. Next. And the last of these maps is actually extremely interesting. It shows where there have been more transactions of property in the last 10 years in London. And if you look at this area here, the Thames Gateway, that's where there have been, together with other parts here, more transactions. But go back one, it still remained a very deprived area. So people have been making money on transactions, but this has not had a lasting impact on the quality of life and the type of community support and services that are there. Next. Next. So let's look at five or six areas that we've studied, which are at the ward level, and the relationship between how accessible they are and their densities. And they're very simple diagram. I'll just pause on the first one. Next. If you take a ward here, which is the ward, it's called Town, which is in West London, and you do a diagram, this is a computer program which looks at the spread of how much of the rest of London is accessible to you from the center of this ward, and you can see in the colors there how many minutes. But basically everything from dark brown to yellow is within an hour, everything from light yellow to gray is over that. Therefore, the more the brown extends, the greater the reach you have from a ward. You see something very interesting. One, go ahead, this is Hammersmith. This is Lambeth, this is Ferndale Ward, which is, help me, in Brixton, thank you. Next, and look what happens in Greenwich. Suddenly it gets shrunk, absolutely, totally. So the notion of sort of segregation, physical segregation from the rest of London, which is so you can feel when you're there, is actually graphically illustrated by this map. Next. That, interestingly, is Tower Hamlets, one of the areas why this area is actually instead benefiting, of course, from quite a lot of investment from the private sector that we've seen. Next. And we go out further east in Newham, and again, the sort of the thing shrinks. So, next. And down in Croydon, it's more widely spread than it was in East London because of the strong connections between Croydon Station and Central London. So if you flick through, Bruno, and flick back very quickly, and forward again. Next. I think you begin to see something quite interesting about the correlations and the issues that need to be addressed effectively to try and avoid areas that, whatever you do to them, however well designed they are, however beautifully the public spaces are made, and how well balanced the space between the public domain and the private domain is, if they're cut off, they will remain that way. Let me try and now bring the talk to its final stages and conclude by looking at some of the projects which are actually happening in the Thames Gateway, which I think are highly problematic in some levels but also highly positive at another. And focus just momentarily on this image here, which is this enormous site called Barking Reach on the north side of the river overlooking the Thames. This is a 5-minute walk from Barking Town Centre, which actually has incredibly strong transport connections at the moment. This is some development from the 70s, and this is all very new development, just completed. Now, the issue clearly becomes, for anyone who is there, what is the future of this area? It's so cut off from its surroundings, you can see it with the eye. This is the site of another maybe 10 to 15,000 housing units which are going to be built there, much higher quality housing, because the Docklands Light Railway were actually is planned to actually go right through the heart of the site over the next 5 or 6 years. Clearly, what might be happening here over time is exactly what we know and we want to try and avoid that has been experienced in the west coast of America and elsewhere. The arrival of gated communities, of exclusive areas for the rich or for the poor, who need in many ways, and I'm not even criticizing that issue, keep themselves apart from the surrounding if there is nothing to sort of sustain the connection and sustain the economies of these different social groups. Next. We've seen this happen before. Canary Wharf in the 70s was this, and it's there. It's still not possible to actually drive through Canary Wharf as a public realm. It's a great attractor of jobs. It's done many good things in terms of the economy of London. But it is not part of what I would call the DNA of London as I described it before. Next. Interestingly to me, when I was involved in assessing the scheme for what has now been built as the Greenwich Millennium Village on the south side of the Greenwich Peninsula, even the great community architect, Ralph Erskine, really didn't know what the hell to do in terms of relating his new village with the rest of the dome. So he put this enormous sort of thing on top to conceal the fact that, you know, I don't know how to connect the city and how to stitch together. This is the problems we architects have. And it's a very genuine social problem which relates to the spatial and relates to the issue of sustained growth over time. Next. And the problem is that if we look at this map now of the new development by Terry Farrell and Meridian Delta, which will link the dome with more housing, what worries me is that no one is thinking now what happens from the rest of this area here to the center of Greenwich, one of London's most wonderful urban centers, and further east to Woolwich. So there's an enormous amount, and to my mind, far too piecemeal development happening in London and has happened over time. And I would not be surprised if all these areas, in the short term at least, become actually segregated areas rather than integrated communities as we've seen them. Next, please. A view of what we all know and like in London, and I was comparing notes with one of my colleagues the other day just to remind ourselves that, you know, parts of Belgravia, parts of Bloomsbury not that long ago were gated. You couldn't go down Gower Street unless you opened a gate. Now, what is interesting and key about that spatial structure over there and the great estates of the 18th century and the 19th century is that when the barriers came down, they became part of the seamless structure of London. And in a way, without talking about style or being romantic about the quality of the architecture, those are the sort of urban structures that I think need to be returned to make the Thames Gateway work. Next. 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 I'm in a way just reminding you of what is there. Those are the opportunities. That's what we're doing with it. That's where it's social housing. That's where it's rich people's housing. Those are the large units which turn their backs to the surroundings similarly there. Next. But, and this is where I want to begin to conclude by connecting what is actually being proposed to what might happen. There are serious proposals now for possibly Cross Wail, certainly Docklands Light Railway and the Thames Gateway Bridge, beginning to sort of feed and irrigate the potential for new development along the Thames Gateway. Next. And I think this is probably one of the key diagrams, I think, in terms of understanding what needs to happen and should happen in London over the next 15 years. Because over here on the left, you have the public transport accessibility, where these fried eggs of yellow show the more red they are, the better public transport provision there is as you go east. If most of the transport infrastructure is put in, which is proposed, you would get a far better connected area around there. Therefore, next, the opportunities must be enormous to begin to think of these areas not as cut off, as many of the developers are now, but as part of an integrated London over time. Next. Many of the sites which are being considered now, from the Lee Valley to Woolwich to parts of the Thames Gateway going towards Rainham. Next. Next. And some of the projects which are already happening. And if we think of Stratford City, which is clearly going to occupy this vast area of railway lands, there is the project which is actually being built. Now, there is no doubt, and many of us in this room have actually in one way or another been part of the discourse of discussion about this city here. You can see it with your eye, that it's very likely that this teardrop shape of the railways which confine the site will remain that way, and many of these parts of Stratford may not benefit from the potential of integration that a development of this sort might deliver. But the Olympics could change this. I'm not sure. It all depends on whether, of course, we get shortlisted. Next. But the potential of the new scheme, all the way down the lower Lee Valley with the area we were looking at over there, which is Stratford City, the potential of this development, actually stitching east-west connections and releasing land for new housing, all of it extremely close to public transport, I think is extremely interesting. But there's a very long way to go in terms of the quality of the architecture and public space. Next. Barking Reach we've talked about before. What is interesting, just to put things in perspective, is that the site we're talking about, if you put a red line around it and put it in this part of London, extends roughly from where we are here in Holborn all the way down to half of St. James Park. Just think of what actually happens in that part of London, the experiences, the institutions, the streets, the squares, the buildings, the universities, and the housing. Next, what was actually proposed here a few years ago was 5,000 units in exactly that sort of model of development that we've seen before. Big urban blocks that turn their back, hog the sort of valuable land facing south. And through a series of interventions, and this is using our role at the GLA as advisors to the mayor, we've actually brought on board a number of Dutch architects who are beginning to think of the site very much as part of the continuity of this whole area, and stitching in and working with the in Sinclair elements of difficult London, which needs to be addressed and brought together. Next, same applies to the area of South Dagenham, where a number of young British architects are now working, stitching together the fabric. Next, next, and also in areas of Barking, where I mentioned already before, many of you know, there's very good public transport. But how do you deal with these sad sort of forgotten areas? And how do you deal with it now before the whole area sort of explodes and becomes sort of divided more so than it is now? Next. Now, I want to conclude really by throwing out a dilemma for me, because I'm not sure where I stand on this. But I think it is a bit at the heart of this discussion of linking the spatial, the social, and the environmental in terms of the debate of London. And it's a lesson very much learned recently in Barcelona, where Richard Sennett, Neil Hobhouse, and other colleagues and I were at a debate and conference where different mayors showed how their cities were changing. And we were all struck by this extraordinary idea, and the mayor of Barcelona put it very sweetly. He said, well, basically, we have a problem. We have the worst area of the city, it's our toilet. I referred to it as our toilet. It's where there's the sewage works, where there's two sort of refineries. He said, unless we do something with that, our city will never be able to grow in that direction, which happens to be east. So they invented something. Next. They invented something called the Forum 2004, which is an event which happens to open next week. What they then did was to continue the great axis of the Diagonal, the part of the Cerdà plan, all the way down to the sea, which had never been done. Invited a series of extremely interesting architects to create a number of great public spaces and places and institutions. Next. Which have ended up with this. This is a model view, even though the reality of it is actually very similar. And really, I want to conclude by sharing with you a concern. Next. That for an area like this, the sort of piecemeal, subtle, project by project, petit projet intervention within the scale of the Thames Gateway may not be enough to actually deliver the urban infrastructure that can support the sustainability I've been talking about. And last slide, let me try and rehearse in a way the key issues that I think Florian addressed are the challenges that we need to respond to. I think London is not, but can be, a sustainable urban model. It requires a sea change in the way that central government thinks about it, and it requires, I think, much greater authority and possibly even centralized authority in the way London is actually run and planning decisions are made. I know that is completely unpopular in many areas. But I believe, and I think I've shared with you, the notion that London as a city physically has the capacity to accommodate growth. The simple question is how. We've also seen that London has an enormous range of dysfunctional areas. There are areas which are poorly served at all levels, not just by transport, but also social services. And we have the opportunity of retrofitting them, and I think in a rather creative way. So the message for me is that working with London's urban grain is critical by building on existing town centers and using as much available land as is possible and as many buildings that are possible. By maximizing permeability, by actually making sure that the links are there, one can avoid ghettos over time. And linking transport to development, which doesn't seem like rocket science really in this room, I think you can resolve many of these issues. I can assure you that many people in Transport for London and many people in the London Development Agency found this a very alien concept only 2 or 3 years ago. So I'm really wanting to conclude that by bringing affordable housing next to other forms of development, one, and by bringing the sort of services which support communities as we've seen in the rest of London, one can avoid creating dormitory towns. But I think if I said before that London is a sustainable city more by default than by design, that equation needs to be turned over just a little bit to keep London as we know it, but also to sustain it in the future. Next slide, please. Thank you very much.
Ricky, thank you very much. I'll invite a few questions in a minute. I just briefly wanted to perhaps try to synthesize some disjunct thoughts that I had listening to Ricky. First of all, I think one of the most important contributions that the Cities Program has made to the school, and I think by extension to the social sciences, has been the reintroduction of this visual perspective on some of this, the objects of social analysis. And I think that that is a great contribution, and I do hope that you will continue to make this, and of course your colleagues as well. I do think that too often we divide our work into sort of functional autist spheres of analysis, and if you look at economics and political science, I think that too often is the problem. And I think that your contribution here and the way you use the visual to understand the way these different processes interact is very important as we move forward. And but enough of my own thoughts. After all of this, this is your opportunity to attack aggressively, wax lyrically, or comment cynically on Ricky's lecture. And I would invite you, and I think in the spirit of the LSE, we'd like to hear from all three sectors of opinion there. Please, I see your hand over there.
Ricky, you, this doesn't seem to be on, is it?
It is.
Ricky, you introduced your presentation by expressing a certain amount of reticence about sustainability. Recently, I was involved in a project undertaken by the London Thames Gateway Forum, which looked at the riverside, not just of London, but the forum itself. And I was impressed by the, negatively impressed, by the amount of land, riverside land, that has already been forfeited, as it were, to residential development. And it seemed to me that there was insufficient reservation of land about further use, non-residential, particularly in view of the prospect of what I think is generally considered to be more and more accepted, the consequences of global warming on rising water levels and the construction and floodplains and so on. One. Second. Do you see any possibility of
if we could limit questions to one question for now, if that's okay, thank you.
Do you want to take more questions?
I think maybe we'll take a few questions. I'll take three or four now and then we'll move forward. There's a question in the back there.
Thanks, Ricky. That was extremely interesting. I wondered if there was a bit of a tension between one of the things you seem to be saying about what the history of London teaches us, which is that London's grown organically and attempts at grand planning have been resisted on the one hand, with what one of the points you seem to be making about Thames Gateway at the end and saying if we're going to learn from the experience of Barcelona, maybe we need a grand vision and piecemeal development in Thames Gateway is not the way to succeed. So I wonder if there's a tension between those two arguments, if I understood them correctly.
Yes.
I think two more questions, just one over here and then over there.
Thank you. My name's Anna Tarnian. I live in Greenwich and have had deep experience of the Millennium Village and the dome which you mentioned. It was a concept from the voluntary sector, in fact from the Forum for the Village and a dome given to the last government and then given personally by me to John Prescott in New York at the UN conference there, and with a competition attached and a strategic transport strategy as well. And he adopted the competition and he adopted the concept, but not the ecological basis of the concept for the village. So what you see going up there, which Erskine won with his consortium, the prize, which you were invigilating on, I believe, or you said you were on the selection committee. So one would not want that necessarily replicated as sustainable, but the intention was it should be self-sustaining. And yes, we have another 10,000 households proposed to go around the dome and offices, and it's going to be pretty jumbly, and won't be self-sustaining, and will also be, as has been mentioned, a threatened by the rising water levels from global warming, climate change, and we warned about that also. So my concern with your research study is that have you been in contact, or have you actually discussed what the voluntary sector, what the community actually wants to see in the Thames Gateway? Because I can assure you that a lot of us are very concerned about the projections that you've mentioned and feel that it's not viable. With John Prescott, in the correspondence I had with him following this, we had suggested there should be, the Millennium Village should be a self-sustaining matrix for three other settlements in the Thames Gateway area, but not what is actually currently being proposed. So I was very delighted to hear that you've got, I mentioned, Dutch architects have become involved, because I'm sure they will have a better balance between the built and the natural environment, which is so necessary.
If you could move to a final question or wrap
what
up.
What process will you be putting in hand in your city's unit in order to bring the community in to the proposals you might be making in your research study?
Just one more over here, and then I do need to recognise.
Thank you, Ricky. That was splendid. But I noticed the stress of your arguments or your perspectives seem to be east-west, rather than north-south. Mm. And it, you did mention the connection between transport and development. It has always appalled me that the south seemed to be so deprived of, with the exception of Croyd you mentioned, of adequate rail lines, metro lines. And I would have thought that if they can build a light railway east-west, they can build light railways north-south too.
One more question up there, and then we'll let Ricky respond.
Thanks. A very brief question. You seem to put quite a lot of value on connectivity between areas. Having my experience is pretty anecdotal, having lived in an extremely well-connected area of Milton Keynes and a pretty boxed-off area behind Los Angeles Airport, it strikes me that actually being cut off stimulates quite a lot of the things that are sustainable. Mixed activity, reducing transport, et cetera, et cetera. Did I understand you right in that respect?
Okay, on the issue of the river and, Jim, what's happened to sort of development over the last, say, 10, 15 years, I sort of agree with you. If you think of what the land that has been released very recently to the east of the Arsenal in Woolwich, one of the prime sites in terms of opportunity for opening up and giving breathing space to that whole part of East London, which I think suffers from access to the river and everything else. And if you think of the, whatever it is, four or five stepped skyscrapers being built there, I don't have a problem with the scale of the buildings. What is the problem there is that no one saw it fit or felt that they should work with the developers in a creative and positive way to make sure that there was a continuity with the hinterland, because there's nothing there now. And I think all this short-termism is really the problem with many of the things which have happened there. Now, this leads into the second question, I think, rather neatly. Yes, there is a tension, and that's what I was trying to articulate. I don't have a solution, and I think it's a tension that needs to be discussed. And this touches on the third question, which is you cannot grow a metropolis of 8 million people on self-sustaining communities. I don't know what they are. I live in Camden, and I tend to know people who don't live in Camden. And the whole point of a metropolis is that it actually cuts across different social group and spatial groups. And how you plan for that is a very difficult thing. The tension, I think, could be an extremely good one. I think the problem at the moment is that we've given up on big planning because on the way it's let's call it as a knee-jerk reaction to the Thatcherite Thatcherite thinking or alongside Thatcherite thinking, planning is bad for you. It's been expensive, it's never worked. Look at all the terrible things of the 60s and 70s. What one is positing here is a model of planning which is much, much more sophisticated, and that does come to the heart, as I think Florian was saying, to thinking about the three-dimensional quality of the spaces you produce, not just about what they're going to be and what their uses are, which is what conventional two-dimensional planning has always done and often got it wrong. So I completely admit to that tension. I'm also, of course, not someone in any position to take any decision about it. But I think it's probably worth acknowledging. The Barcelona example I show as a slight provocation, because I don't even know how that area is going to work. Certainly the Olympic Village did transform the relationship between that city and its seafront in a way that I think London could do that. So if one connects Jim's point about, say, Woolwich and other areas which have been privatized and turn their back to the city, you need a strong public hand or custodian of the public realm to do that. And it's very interesting how it seems to me in New York that works extremely well, regardless of the political color of the management. Our work on some of the research we're doing, a question about voluntary and do we talk to the community question, this piece of work, which has gone on now for a year and a half, very much narrows down with a lot of qualitative sociological work by asking residents and people who live in these, inverted commas, denser areas, what's it like? What are the benefits and what are the disbenefits? And that's a whole other chapter, and obviously I won't talk about it now. The difficulty with asking the question, what do you want the Thames Gateway to be like, is who do you ask? Because if you take Tony Travers's statistics accurate, and if they're accurate, which I think they are, most of the people actually moving into London are now living in Riga, Barcelona, or Naples. And they're not the people who are going to be living in most of the community. This doesn't mean for a moment that the residents and the those who are there at the moment need to be taken into account. I see with the same cynicism, I think, that you do, some of the problems that have evolved in the Greenwich Millennium Village. But it's also back to the issue of whose project is it? That is a project which is owned and run by a private developer who needs to make X return on its investment because they have shareholders. And again, I think the public sector needs to take a much more proactive role in deciding who supports the schools, for example, and who provides the sort of social infrastructure, which, in fact, in the Greenwich Millennium Village have not and will never be provided until there's a critical mass and the cycle changes. In Germany and Holland, they provide the schools and the social institutions before the housing, and I think there's a clear lesson there. The north-south issue, you're absolutely right. I didn't talk about the importance of the orbital railway, which I think is central in making that connection. The East London Line connection could use, could be extended using existing track, basically linking, say, the areas of North London, Camden, through East London, Bishopsgate, down to south. And I think that is something which needs to be pushed, and you probably heard that the mayor is suggesting using his new powers of, what's it called, prudential borrowing or something, extraordinary concept, to actually take over the East London Line extension to make that link. The simple answer to your question is that all the proposals for the Cross River tramway link and others are at the moment in the hands of the Treasury to decide, and they're too expensive, and their business case valuations don't take into account something called urban value. So we have a problem. The last point about connectivity in Milton Keynes. Yes, you're right. Connectivity needs to be talked about, and I hope in some of the things I was showing, if not saying, you get an impression that by connectivity one talks about a much more subtle grain of difference. If you think, just to help this discussion, of the Bill Hillier map of London, right, which has, yes, big avenues like Oxford Street, yes, Edgware Road, and the A40, But also within that, there's a much more subtle grain, you know, the Jane Jacobs-like analysis of the urban grid and its deformations and local aberrations which actually make difference. That delivers the sort of intensity and difference which makes your and many others' experience of living in a city actually desirable. So my notion of connectivity was not just from A to B at a global level, but very much trying to have that degree of diversity, difference, and sort of subtlety, which relates very much to my initial points about the DNA of London.
Thank you for that initial response. We do have another 10, 15 minutes, and I think it'd be worthwhile to...
Five?
Ricky's getting tired. just to add to my opportunity here to let off my pet rants, I think apart from the engagement of the Gestalt for analytical reasons, I think it's that curious lack of civic passion, or that at least the lack of passion for the aesthetic quality of urban space that London always suffers from. And again, I think your presentation perhaps can add to it reigniting that. I have at least two more comments here. The first one on the right down there, and then we'll move to the Upper House and over there. So.
Andrew Lepage, an alumni and also here from the North London Waste Authority. I'm somewhat concerned at the lack of attention in a way to London's great need for infrastructure. And there seems to, I'm not sure that an adequate balance is being struck between the needs of form and the needs of function. You spoke of Barcelona doing away with the major sewage treatment works, and London needs...
Not doing away with it.
I thought you were suggesting
they're
doing
away with it. No, the interesting thing is that they plonked their great civic forum on top of all these structures.
Ah.
No, that's the interesting
point.
Because so they took the difficult toilet and worked with it.
Okay, my concern was where are the energy needs coming from? Where's the rubbish going to go to? Where's the sewage going to go to? You know, with this amount of development, we're going to have to reserve land for those sorts of things as well as for the people to live in and get the balance right.
I can't answer that.
Next question over there, please.
Actually, my question was related to waste as well, and challenges, like, if it's taken into account at all
you
when issues of urban form? No? Okay. It was just regarding waste and recycling. It's never mentioned in most things.
Unfortunately, I don't know enough about waste.
Okay. I think I had another one over there. Yes, please. And then, yes.
I noticed that your talk took the topic about predict and provide right here. You pretty much took a predict and provide mentality on urban growth, population growth in London, and I assume that was because of your training as an architect. I'm curious, do you have a comment on ideas such as diverting net migration to London to other major cities in England, to just prevention of migration at all, barring, of course, ideas like Jean-Marie Le Pen? Just wondering if you can make a comment. Thanks.
One very final question, please, over there.
I'd like to ask about the distribution of jobs within London. Is there a case for shifting employment from a very high concentration in the centre to the inner and suburban rings, which would reduce average work journeys and help traffic congestion? I'm sure mobility is a good thing, but sometimes you can have too much of it for comfort.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, I mean, the first wonderful provocation is that predict and provide is a sort of an architectural concept. 98% of my profession doesn't know what that term means. I come to it as a member of the Urban Task Force in listening carefully to the arguments of planners and demographic experts and economists, and don't see it at all as a sort of architectural model, which is, from what you're suggesting, a wonderful opportunity just to create something, whether it's Milton Keynes, Chandigarh, and then see whether you can fill it up. I think what is interesting about the predict and provide model is that it is more subtle and more responsive in terms of what can actually happen in terms of the growth of the city. I think, and this may be possibly also related to the last question, and I am well outside my area of expertise here, but the notion of diverting growth to other parts of the UK, the notion of, say, diverting or distributing jobs to other parts of London where they naturally are, deals with issues which seem to me so intrinsically related to not just London-wide and national forces, but to global forces, that it is nearly impossible in the light of what we know today about how decisions are made in terms of the world economy to make those sorts of decisions. The location of Heathrow, Gatwick, and Stansted are going to be much more important in terms of answering your questions of where jobs are going to be located and therefore where people are going to go and live than any decision Ken Livingstone will ever make. And I think these are, you know, patently obvious issues. And I think probably the same sort of answer might apply, even though I'm not sure of what I'm saying, in terms of distribution of employment in other parts of London. I mean, London clearly has certain, and that's very interesting about it, has areas of focusing on different types of activity, the City Corporation being one, Canary Wharf, interestingly, being another. And if we remember the warfare between these two then enemies only 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, it's interesting to see how the city in many ways has won and retained its position of sort of the corporate headquarters excellence, and Canary Wharf has very happily occupied the sort of the back office with deep floors and all the spatial requirements that that requires. The interesting issues are, you know, what happens to Stratford City? What is that ultimately? Who's going to move there? Will it be in competition with the others? Again, I doubt, because London is so profoundly mercantile at its roots. We've seen it from everything I think I've been saying probably for the last 2,000 years. London is essentially mercantile. It's driven by money. It's driven by people who make decisions about money, whether it's whether to trade with the East India Company or whether it's to do with where banking headquarters are located in Canary Wharf, that I would imagine that it's quite difficult to reverse these trends. Otherwise, London wouldn't be what it is, and you wouldn't get the sort of influx, the sort of net migration from the international community, which I think is genuinely feeding London in the best way possible and changing its actual feel over time.
Thank you very much, Ricky. I think, once again, this is a fantastic lecture. I always agree to chair Ricky's lectures because I know I'll be wide awake at the end of them. So, once again, thank you very much. Thank you for coming. I'd like to say thank you for Nat Holtman, who's been organizing LEN events for the past few years with unerring efficiency, and will also now be available to answer any questions that you may have about joining the network. And I would encourage you to do so. It's a rather insignificant charge, but you would be supporting a whole range of activities, lectures, and other events. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your participation and your questions. And thank you, Ricky, again, and have a good night.